Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the Danny Meyer Restaurant Group, Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, Maialino, and Untitled. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and you'll find us every Wednesday at 11 a.m. on the Heritage Radio Network, where we're talking about taste. And today's topic is particularly close to my heart because for the last few months, we've been working at the Beard Foundation on putting together a conference, a national conference on food and sustainability and public health, which is taking place this week. In fact, we're taping the show early so that we can all be running around the Hearst Tower. Our co-host is Good Housekeeping, and we have a bunch of partners, and we've been working for months and months, really, to put together a conversation about two topics that related to sustainability and public health that we think are really important, actually related to food in general, and they are money and media. And with me today in the studio for today's conversation are the two people who have helped more than anyone frame this conversation, both ideologically and also logistically. How do we address these two giant topics, money and media, and what does that mean when we're talking about food, and how can we do something effective with a group of thought leaders in a room for a couple of days in New York City? So it's a real pleasure to welcome Joseph McIntyre, who is the founder and director and president and all-knowing person at Ag Innovations Network in California, and Karen Karp, president and founder of Karp Resources, a consultant. And I welcome to the show, both of you. It's a pleasure to have you here in person after so many emails and phone calls and conference calls and things in anticipation of this exciting week. And I want to start, let's just start in here, since I'm not sure that everyone knows what the roles are in the sustainability world, what it is that the two of you do. Joseph, why don't you start talking about what it is that Ag Innovations Network is and what you do?
Well, thanks a lot, Mitchell. It's great to be here. It's a pleasure to be in New York. I'm president of Ag Innovations Network, which is a small nonprofit based in California. We're about 60 miles north of San Francisco. And what we're doing in California is working with communities to build the new food system. Whether that means changing policies, actually building new infrastructure, whatever it's going to take to actually create a food system that reflects their values most authentically. So it's a big job. We have kind of an interesting role in it that we're sort of experts in how to get people to work together, particularly people who don't work together very much. And I really spend my life talking with people from often who are, quote, on different sides. And so I'm very interested in where's the emerging common ground in the food system, and how do we take advantage of identifying that and taking action around it? So it's been a real honor to work in that space.
And it's been a real honor to have you bring those skills of bringing people together to talk about difficult things from various sides. It's one of the models that we created together for the James Beard Food Conference, in that we want to engage voices and perspectives from a really diverse number of background, so many different areas that it's hard to even imagine when you look through the list of participants. And we'll get back to that. Karen, tell us what Karp Resources does.
Sure. Karp Resources, I founded the company 21 years ago, initially as a restaurant consulting company and firm. And over the years, I've just been very lucky to be exposed to and have the opportunity to work also with different groups of people, different sectors. Our clients are business, government, and nonprofit. And what we do with them is help them identify new business models of working together. So like Joseph, we sort of take the systems as they are and get people to work differently within them with each other. So we like to be right in there with the biggest systems, the departments of health and big corporations and biggish size ag, to try to help them identify opportunities to do things differently and to shift to working towards a more sustainable food distribution system, production system, etc.
Great. So let's go to first principles, and I know this is an impossible question to ask, but both of what you have said that you do is to help improve or change or create a new food system. What's wrong with the one we've got, in a nutshell, Joseph?
Well, you know, I think I'm going to start with the title of your of the show. The stuff that we're getting to eat doesn't taste very good, and it doesn't taste very good for a lot of reasons. Often it's overprocessed. Often it's produced in a way which the soils have been stripped of their nutrients. We've made a tremendous sacrifice or a choice about balancing efficiency versus taste, which I think some of us are beginning to examine whether or not that was a good balance, especially in light of the sort of the health impacts of our current system and the fact that 7 out of the 10 lowest paid jobs in America today are in growing and managing and delivering food to us every day. So there's something about this system that doesn't reflect our deepest aspirations and values about what matters. And that's that's kind of where I start the train.
Mm-hmm. Karen?
So I agree. A lot of the problem is around the value, where we place the value on the thing that we need every day as humans and as a planet to move forward. I actually get myself in a lot of hot water in a lot of places by saying, actually, there's a lot of things about the system that aren't broken. There are many things that are working, and they're overworking, they're over-efficient. We humans and societies design systems to work for the values that we have at the moment. And I think where we have come from is the need to produce calories and the need to grow a country. And that was our need 100 years ago, 80 years ago, 60 years ago. The needs are shifting as the results or the impacts of that incredible efficiency has started to show us where there are weaknesses. So what is important now is to identify what the new strengths are and what the new values are and to rebuild those into, hopefully, parts of the existing system that can be retooled for the kind of food values that we want and need going forward.
Interesting. I'll remind our listeners at home that you can actually watch some of the proceedings of the conference at jbffoodconference.org, where we're live streaming some of the presentations and where there is an active blog post comment thing so that you can actually engage in the conversation that we're having that all of us are actually hosting right now. So let's move the need for the food system, the larger food system in general, to the Beard Foundation and this sort of realm of taste and sort of high taste or low taste or whatever you want to say, but chefs and restaurants. And what is unique, since both of you work with such different constituencies and with different problems, what's unique about the restaurant business and the role that chefs who've become such important leaders in terms of where the country stands on food, to engage them? Why now? Why this conference? Joseph?
Well, you know, I think it's a kind of a simple thing. Nobody actually puts the whole problem and the whole opportunity of the food system in front of us every day in the way a chef does. What gets plated is a statement. It's a statement about provenance. It's a statement about beauty, aesthetics, and taste. And so it's natural to me that chefs were among the first to begin to ask some questions. Where does the stuff come from? How do I get the best possible taste? What's the best possible way to create the experience I'm trying to create in my restaurant and in eaters? And so it's also the conviviality of it. I mean, we all owe a tremendous debt to Carlo Petrini and the slow food movement, you know, who just sort of pointed out the fact that at the table we do a lot of good work. Mm-hmm. And some of that work is eating, and some of that work is understanding eating. And so I think it's a natural locus point. It's not the only one, but it's a natural locus point for having a conversation about food and society. Hmm.
Karen, anything unique about this aspect?
Well, chefs are the world's great enthusiasts, right? They're also captains of ships. And I think one of the things, as Mitchell, you and I have experienced in salons we've led all around the country, is we get chefs to come out and share their enthusiasm about food, but really it's an exception. They are typically in their restaurants working 16 hours a day trying to make this very complex system work from a excitement, taste, flavor point of view, work from a labor point of view, work from a profit point of view, work from an enjoyment, entertainment point of view. And we see chefs as sort of being helms of this really important system and have so much attraction from the media and from the fields of entertainment and culture that we see them as real levers of change. We're trying to identify ways that they can actually do that a little bit more outside of their restaurants. So chefs are it for us. They're the levers that we're looking for in this whole endeavor with the James Beard Foundation and sustainability.
And it's interesting because, in fact, in anticipation of the conference, we issued two surveys. One, our co-host Good Housekeeping sent to their readers, who are primarily women who provision food for their families. I think upwards of 5 million of them. And the Beard Foundation sent out a survey to chefs about both their personal experiences and their decisions about food for their families, but also for their environments. And taste came really high for the chefs. Taste in the sense that, you know, when you're going to choose a product, when you're going to choose a decision about what to cook or how to prepare it, that it's flavor and taste and those sorts of things that come at the top of the list. And so one of the things that I know you both know is my personal question is that is like, what role does the actual flavor of things play in sustainability? We talk about how things are produced so that they're done fairly and that people have access to them and that people are treated well. But does anything of that have to do with how the food actually tastes in the end, or ought to? And if it did, what would that look like?
Can I go first on this one? So I guess maybe part of it is hanging around with you as much as I've been doing the last 2 years. But especially also because we do a lot of work with low-income communities and helping to change the eating behaviors in low-income communities, particularly to be consuming more fresh fruits and vegetables. I actually think maybe one consistent thing everywhere along the food chain, if you think about a chef, if you think about a food company, if you think about a marketing company, if you think about a farmer's market, farmer, and down to the consumer level, actually everybody is making a decision or a formula around taste. So taste is actually driving essentially the business model. Now, sometimes taste is driving the business model into an unhealthy direction, but taste is actually the most important driver. If people are not going to eat it, it doesn't matter whether it's healthy. If people aren't going to eat it, it doesn't matter whether it's the most sustainably produced anything. So maybe taste is the organizing principle that the sustainability movement has been lacking.
I like to think so. At least I like to think that we're contributing that. How about someone with a different perspective, perhaps Jonathan?
Yeah.
Jonathan, sorry. I just did that. Joseph.
Again.
I gotta get the good. J Joseph, names out of
Joseph, Jonathan. You know, it's all. We're all on the J train.
Hey,
You know, I actually think that it's a kind of a simple thing. Taste is one of the primary indicators for well-being. So one of the things that I know that you've experienced in some of the gastronomical training and the taste training is that the ability to discern the differences in a thing according to the where it was grown, the kinds of soils, the kinds of nutrients it had access to. In the end, we were exquisitely evolved to be able to discern that which was healthy from that which was not. And to some extent in America, I know as I grew up, we weren't really cultivated to understand those nuances of taste. But as I've learned more about it, I've realized that for all the things that I care about as an environmentalist, as a person interested in social justice, as somebody who cares about farmers' well-being economically and socially, that it comes out in the actual taste of the tomato, in the actual type of wheat that we grow and what's produced into. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a fabulous indicator for well-being in the system.
And wholesomeness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's sort of another aspect of it that in lots of meetings where I sit around with people who are working with some of the biggest food corporations and about sustainability and about all these efforts to procure more sustainable product. For example, you know, a Rainforest Alliance certified tea from Unilever, you know, 12% of the world's black tea is going to be certified sustainable. And we're pretty lucky that Lipton tea tastes pretty good. It's a, you know, pretty good tea. But these conversations that are going on in these big companies are really looking at the agriculture aspects, the water scarcity, the labor rights, the livelihoods. They're looking at really, really, really important topics. But flavor and taste are generally not part of that same conversation. Mm-hmm. They happen in an R&D lab. They happen with a chef who's in a lab coat doing, you know, having consumers come in and do tastings, but it's not all part of an integrated decision-making process. And mm-hmm. I think that that's a real opportunity for the future of sustainability with regard to large-scale agriculture and food manufacturing, is to have those conversations really taking place at the same time.
Mm-hmm. I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. It's funny to have to say that twice. And I'm talking here with Joseph McIntyre, whose name is not Jonathan. Joseph McIntyre from Ag Innovations Network, and Karen Karp from Karp Resources. And we're talking about taste and sustainability, and actually the James Beard Foundation Food Conference, the second iteration of which is happening this week as you're listening. You can watch some of the presentations and participate in the conversation at jbffoodconference.org. So let's talk about the process of putting this conference together, because I think it's an interesting one. And we've, Karen, you and I, and also Joseph, have been part of a system that has taken us around the country, really, to listen to people talking about issues that, that we're going to be discussing this week. Yep. Tell us a little bit about...
Yeah, so when we, as I recall it, because it's now a little over 2 years ago, as I recall it, we were looking at the James Beard Foundation's 25th anniversary, which is next month, mm-hmm. and looking at how the foundation could look to do more things, look to engage communities around the country, look to really expand its presence, and the way that it has a presence in the United States with chefs, restaurateurs, food writers, etc. And we thought, well, we really need to hear what's going on around the country. We could have a conference in any city, any time of the year, but not everybody's going to be able to get there. So we decided we would go and hear the people in their places. And the very first thing we did was go to Portland, Oregon, which was the birthplace and home of James Beard for many years, and start what we call salons, which are regional conversations with chefs, with farmers, with policymakers, with activists, with food companies, with distributors, with purveyors. Just get 20 people around a table and have a conversation about food. And mm-hmm. we've done 8 or 9 of these mm-hmm. salons now, as they are kind of accumulating over the course of 2 years. And we've been on the West Coast, we've been in the Midwest, we've been in the Northeast, we've been in the Southeast. And besides the fact that they're enormously fun mm-hmm. occasions, we are hearing perspectives from different parts of the country differently. Some people are saying the same thing everywhere, and other people are saying things differently depending on where they are.
A few examples of what we've heard, of what comes to mind?
In the Northwest, and that's where we started, we were impressed, and I think we are still impressed, with the role that policymakers are taking in taking food systems and policies, particularly around procurement and the value of food. They're just taking them on, and they're saying, we are going to, you know, we're going to put forth and we're going to do whatever we can to drive a policy that will allow us to spend 10% more on more mm-hmm. sustainably or locally produced food. That's a kind of policy atmosphere that is very difficult to justify in other parts of the country. Mm-hmm. In Portland, Maine, we had people from all over Maine, and I think one of the things that I remember from Portland is Maine kind of wanted to go off the grid.
Yes.
You know, take Maine, have Maine. Maine wants to secede and sort of retake ownership of its land food and reallocate system. It mm-hmm. to smaller, more regional farmers. Those are some of the things that stood out for me in the two Portlands.
Sure. Something that Karen just said, Joseph, that I'd like you to comment on is this idea of local and sustainable, and the way that they're linked, and the way that's good and the way that that's problematic, if it is, in fact, it's become an answer, I think. I'm not sure it's the complete answer to the question, but could you comment on that?
Yeah, sure. You know, I want to start with a premise. Mm-hmm. There's the food system that we have today has multiple components, and it will always have multiple components. It's going to have a component that's largely a local source, small business. I think it's an aspect of the food system that over the past 100 years has atrophied, and we're now actually trying to see it strengthen again. But it's not a replacement for the full food system, which may have much larger producers, much larger food companies involved, who also have a deep commitment to sustainability. So I think that's the first thing I want to make the point here. There's two different things going on.
And I'm going to cut you off, and we'll get to point two just after a break, if that's okay.
Thanks.
You're listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis.
On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch. our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
One evening as the sun went down and the jungle fire was burning, down the track came a hobo hiking, and he said, "Boys, I'm not turning. I'm headed for a land that's far away, beside the crystal fountains. So come with me, we'll go and see the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, there's a land that's fair and bright, where the handouts grow on bushes, and you sleep out every night. Where the boxcars all are empty, and the sun shines every day. On the birds and the bees and the cigarette trees, the lemonade springs where the bluebird sings, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains, all the cops have wooden legs, and the bulldogs all have rubber teeth, and the hens lay soft-boiled eggs. The farmer's trees are full of fruit, and the barns are full of hay. Oh, I'm bound to go where there ain't no snow, where the rain don't fall, the wind don't blow, in the Big Rock Candy Mountains. In the Big Rock Candy Mountains."
Welcome back to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and you're listening on the Heritage Radio Network. We're talking about sustainability and food and taste and the James Beard Foundation Food Conference, which is going on right now as you're listening. You can watch some of the presentations at jbffoodconference.org and also participate in some of the conversations. There's about 125 thought leaders from various aspects of the food world, from giant global companies to small independent restaurants and large media organizations and small media organizations and farmers and all sorts of things in between. We're really excited to be in our second year, really the third iteration of the gathering, but the second year of the actual conference. And we're talking here with two people who've been instrumental in putting it together and in giving it the direction that it's taken. Joseph McIntyre, who's the president of Ag Innovations Network, a nonprofit that works with various communities to support sustainability in California and also nationally, and Karen Karp, who's based in New York City, president of Karp Resources, who works with various types of organizations, governmental, policy, individual businesses, trying to increase access and availability of wholesome, sustainable food. Thank you again for joining us for this conversation. So, Joseph, before we left for the break, I had asked you, and then rudely cut you off, about the relationship between local and global and the way that local has come to stand in as a surrogate, really, for sustainability. And yet we know we're all part of this global food thing. And certainly here in Brooklyn at Roberta's is probably about as local a restaurant as you could get, since they're growing the greens on the roof and out the back and, you know, the everywhere. But even then, you know, there's olive oil on the menu and there are things that are part of a global system. So if you could pick up that conversation, give us point two and maybe remind us about point one would be great.
So the first point is that these two systems don't exist apart from each other. They're intricately intertwined, and they should be. They're what makes a Roberta's possible. But that being said, you know, all of us are looking for a proxy for something that says there's actually not just a promise in the thing that I'm buying, but an actuality. And I think the thing that local gives us and why we associate local with sustainability is that it's one of the few places where we actually can connect our eyeballs and our tongues and our ears to the actual thing that is the food in the food system. It's not a brand, it's not a media campaign, it's the real thing. You can see the greens growing here. And so, I mean, I think the connection between local and sustainable at that one level is just about proximity. But I also think that there is something else that's really important, and it actually has a lot to do with the economic development of the food system, and that one of the things that's important element of sustainability is the viability of our local food economies. And so I do think that there's another thing that's going on about relocalization, which is putting more economic energy into building mm-hmm. local entrepreneurship and local businesses as a means for accomplishing something that we care deeply about, which is better tasting food, but also something we also care deeply about, which is a more employed, more economically vibrant community. And I think that Roberta's, again, is a wonderful example of that.
Karen, do you have thoughts about that topic?
I have
brief.
Yes, lots of thoughts about the interconnection between local and sustainable. And the thing I'm thinking about as Joseph is speaking is something that's a little hard to talk about because it's happening tomorrow. But by the time people hear this, it will have happened yesterday. Tomorrow we are going on, there are four discovery tours that are part of the James Beard Conference going on tomorrow. Three that are taking place in various neighborhoods in New York City and one that's taking place in the Hudson Valley in Orange County, the Black Dirt region of Orange County. And the Black Dirt region of Orange County is the area closest to New York with the most vibrant agriculture community. It stays that way because the land can't be built on. It's silt from volcanoes and icebergs and everything, and it just can't be built on, so it's great for growing food. And when Irene passed through here a few weeks ago, more than 80% of most farmers' crops were destroyed at the uh-huh. height of the season. So here we are in New York City depending on these farmers to supply our farmers' markets, and these farmers are devastated. And we're going to take eight people tomorrow to look at some of this devastation, mm-hmm. whereas they thought they were going to be looking at Harvest Bounty. And I think that these big weather incidents are horrible and awful, and especially when you know some of these farmers like I do, but they're also a wake-up call to take notice of the fact that actually there are some good things about being in a national and a global food system. We are not going to go hungry because we only have to eat local food, and these farmers are going to figure out a way to engage with farmers in other places to re-up their supply chains. And so I think all of the things that are happening climatically are ways to one of the ways to look at what local really means.
Mm-hmm. Great, interesting, and very timely. So the theme that we'll be talking about, or the framework for the conference in the next couple of days, is money and media and how they influence the way America eats. And why don't we, in the few minutes we have remaining, look at some of those tiny little topics and tease out a few things that you think are important to talk about. Why don't we start up with media? Where here we are on a radio show, mm-hmm. sitting in a restaurant. I was fascinated this weekend in the New York Times. There was a piece on the production of food television commercials and paying how companies pay $160,000 a day to get the perfect shot of a squirt of lemon or whatever, and it involves teams of people, and it's all about getting people to consume yep. products and eat money actually literally eat money but eat more
money.
So what have we been hearing, Karen, as we've been traveling around the country talking about these issues?
Well, one of the premises of this topic, media and money, is how popular food TV has become over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years, maybe a little bit longer, and how powerful chefs are and how powerful celebrity figure chefs have become. And what can we do with that? How can we arrest that popularity? How can we arrest that power to help create the kind of change we want for mm-hmm. the food system that we say we want? So one of the things that we've been doing at the salons is showing people all sorts of images of chefs in the media and asking, what's your reaction to that? Like, when you see it objectively, what do you think? And a lot of people have responded in a way that I think makes us feel sort of happy about the direction we're going, which is chefs have an enormous potential to be leaders. They are now popular and it's populist, so let's arrest that and use it for leadership. Mm-hmm. Let's use it to kind of create the lever to have chefs be able to say, have different kinds of messages. But then, of course, we get into the money part of the system and start analyzing where the money is made and by which chefs and whom and what gender are they and on what television shows and what's the background when they're on these shows and who are they speaking to and what time of the day are they on. And that led us, I think, to think a lot about the money system that's behind the media system mm-hmm. that's then also behind the food system.
Joseph, if you had a celebrity chef in front of you who had this platform because of the celebrity that he or she has been given, what would you want him or her to say? And what would help your work? I didn't mean to make you speechless on the radio. That's not such a good thing.
Yeah, really, I tell you, Mitchell, it's like I'm trying to think of which chef I'd say and what I'd ask him. You know, I think the question that's most up for me is, how are you striking the balance between doing well and doing good? Mm-hmm. Because it's a constant tension. There's the necessity to make payroll, And that's critical. There's also the necessity to make taste roll, if you would, right? It's got to, we've got to make this thing come out. And you know, we've got to figure out a way for my expression as a chef to have some life, some longevity. And so how are you balancing it? Where do you draw the dividing lines between in ingredients, in local versus non-local suppliers? And how do you do that? And are you doing that consciously? How are you finding the balance between, you know, wages and profits? And because I think in the end, one of the keys about local is about coming back and grappling with that raw basic reality. How do we actually make it work in everyday businesses along, you know, Morgan Street? It's as simple as that.
And it's funny to be in Brooklyn here, where actually a whole a movement about food has begun and has grown and continues to grow and actually influence certainly this area, but to some extent because of the proximity of media concentrated here in New York City, it's become a model for things that have happened elsewhere in the country, Portland, Minneapolis, places we've been, that we've seen really dynamic local food communities emerge. And you can't help but feel like we're at a tipping point. I mean, it could be a trend, and everyone keeps asking, is it just a trend? Are people just interested now because Gwyneth Paltrow was on the cover of a food magazine that suddenly everyone's paying attention? Or is it something bigger than that? And as two people who've been working for so many years in this area and are now in the midst of this sort of bubble of interest and excitement, what do you think? Is some fundamental change underfoot?
I think so. And the reason I think so is because it sounds quite banal, but everybody has to eat, and people are curious and concerned and have decided not to trust the status quo so much anymore.
Well, because
about
cantaloupes
food.
Are killing them.
Cantaloupes are killing them, beef is killing them, eggs are killing them, scallions are killing them. Right. I mean, every time there is a big food outbreak, it's a huge opportunity for people to sort of wake up and say, wait a second, what do I really know about my food? Other industries are going to change dramatically over the years. The auto industry has changed dramatically. The technology industry has changed dramatically. These kinds of industries are requiring fewer and fewer people to make them work. Food actually is an industry that, at the end of the day, still requires a lot of people to make it work. And so food is one of the things that's being looked at as revitalization strategies for inner cities, for Detroit, for Chicago, for Cleveland, for Indianapolis, for Boston. So food is really being looked at as an industry that is inherently local, which is different than how we are normally talking about local when we talk about food. But the food industry is inherently local, and it is a job maker and a job creator and a person fulfiller. So I think there's no end in sight. Then you add the health issues on to the problems that we have to solve with food, and it becomes daunting, but a big slate of work ahead for most of us.
Joseph?
I don't think there's any question that we're at the beginning of something big. You know, we transition from the industrial society, the post-industrial society, to the information society. What's next? You know, it's clear, and sitting here in New York City, I can't help but mention the fact that, you know, there are thousands of people gathered, quote, occupying Wall Street, raising questions about, you know, what is in it for, as they would describe themselves, the 99% of America. They're asking these fundamental questions. What is the good life? You know, la dolce vita. And I think when you ask that question, you can't help but come back to talk about, what am I putting into my body every day? How does that make me feel? How does it connect me to my neighbors? How does it affect my children? And I think it forces you to begin to rethink, what are we on the right path? And so I don't think those questions are going to go away. I think that we've embedded them deep in the minds and the consciousness of thousands, millions of consumers. And it's not just the well-to-do. This is organizing that it's occurring in the most challenging parts of Oakland. Nikki Henderson and the work that she's doing with People's Grocery is exemplary in that. And I know there's lots of great examples right here in New York City. Green Carts, for example, is a wonderful one. So there's, you know, I just don't see us as doing anything but continuing to push the boundaries here. Is it a movement? I would suggest that it's something even more fundamental than that.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, and I would say that the Beard Foundation tonight actually is inaugurating its new leadership awards for people working in these areas. And we are, in fact, hoping to help give a platform to some of the people like yourselves who have really instigated incredible change and shown tremendous leadership in these areas, and in the hopes that giving them a more celebrity profile, a higher platform, will help them accomplish their work. And you can see details about that also on jbffoodconference.org. Thank you for joining me, the two of you, and those of you at home listening, Karen Karp, president of Karp Resources, and Joseph McIntyre, who is the president of Ag Innovations Network. This is a great conversation, and in fact, Karen has agreed to host the occasional show, and on November 2nd, she will be, I'm sure, picking up some of the themes that we've talked about today in a further conversation about sustainability and taste. Next week, that's the 19th of October, we'll be chatting about a trend happening in Scandinavia with Adam Ammann, who is opening the first Danish restaurant in New York in eons, and part of a new trend in Nordic cuisine. Right now, the center of the gastronomic world at a certain elevated level, people believe has left Spain and has moved north, headed north to Denmark and Scandinavia, and we'll have an interesting conversation about that, and maybe he'll bring some smørrebrød with us, or smørrebrød, or however one pronounce that. Smørrebrød. I'm getting coaching, linguistic coaching from our Nordic associate producer, Ashley Koziak. Anyway, you've been listening to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. Join us every Wednesday at 11 a.m. on Heritage Radio Network. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following message has been brought to you by Taste Brooklyn. Our city's finest chefs partner with farmers and local vineyards next to the Green Market for an extraordinary outdoor culinary festival. Try exquisite delicacies using locally grown seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Feel to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's TASTESOF Brooklyn.blogspot.com.